Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. You ain't gonna be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Blacks won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economic. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control business and industry, and put that pools in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for at least. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations got the money. That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk only control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75, 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. And so you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. You only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate them. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March for what? Who cares? Marching, they never changed anything.
Come on. Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
But you say, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles. The kid no one would pick. Was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
African Americans have been in Kansas since before the Civil War. They wanted what all settlers wanted, a chance to choose their future. Many of them came after the Civil War because they saw Kansas as a land of freedom. They had learned about John Brown as well as the stories of the Underground Railroad supporters. This gave them the idea that Kansas was the promised land. Kansas was larger in the 1860s than it is today. One of the many anti-slave supporters, also sometimes called an abolitionist, was James Lane. He assisted in getting slaves from the southern states of slavery to the freedom that could be gained in Canada. The Underground Railroad would use everyday homes like this one that was along the trail. Lane developed this trail in the state that would link up with other trails throughout the United States. In an attempt to keep the African Americans safe, they had to be hidden, sometimes in attics, cellars, or tunnels. Even before Kansas became a state, there was a settlement of runaway slaves within the boundaries of the territory. It was established in 1857 near what is known today as Kansas City, Kansas. Quindaro was the area the escapees would first reach free soil. They would sometimes move on to the Happy Hollow colony nearby. During this time, the Wyandot Indians surrounded the area. It is known that eventually about 110 farming families were known to have lived in that area. When Kansas became a state on January 29th of 1861, it entered the United States as a free state. A few short months later, the Civil War began. Even with Kansas being a free state, it was on the border. And just as the country was divided, so was Kansas. There were places that didn't want blacks in their neighborhoods, towns, or communities. Some of these towns became known as sundown towns. Here is a list of towns that is believed to have been sundown towns in Kansas, based on census reports. This is a map showing just how widespread the problem was across the state. With the end of the Civil War, the African Americans were looking for a way to begin their new lives of freedom. Organizations within Kansas sent out flyers as well as representatives to encourage them to settle in Kansas. Many of the African Americans traveled the many rivers to arrive in Kansas. According to the website sponsored by the Black Town Project organization, they settled in these counties across the state. It was believed that for the African Americans to have a chance of a future in Kansas, they would need to have their own town. So Nicodemus was formed, an Indiana land developer, as well as the Reverend W.H. Smith, worked together to form the Nicodemus Town Company. The Nicodemus Town Company promoted to colored people of the United States to come and settle in the Great Solomon Valley. The first settler to arrive in 1877 was the Reverend Roundtree. He worked with Benjamin Papp Singleton, a black carpenter who was a prior slave, to continue to spread the word about Kansas. Many of the early settlers arrived from Kentucky. In the late fall, they did not have time to build a home before the harsh winter would arrive. So they built temporary homes called dugouts. Nicodemus brought the state its first black elected official, Edward P. McCabe. McCabe was the Nicodemus Town Company elected secretary and later the state auditor. Governor St. John appointed him to Graham County Clerk's office in April of 1880. After the railroad failed to be located in Nicodemus, the population dwindled. Nicodemus currently has 40 residents and is listed as a national historical site. The descendants of the original settlers returned to Nicodemus in July to celebrate their heritage. Benjamin Singleton, who was sometimes known as Pap, sparked many of the blacks that became known as the Exodusters to migrate to Kansas from 1879 to 1881. It is said he was responsible for the movement of 300 African Americans to Kansas. He aided in the development of three separate colonies in the state: Singleton, Tennessee Town, and Dunlap. Dunlap was his best attempt. It was funded with the aid of the Southern Refugee Relief Association as well as the Presbyterian Church. Governor St. John was a big part of the Southern Refugee Relief Association. It was in response to the large numbers of refugees that had arrived within the state with little to no resources available to them. Dunlap offered the freed slaves a free education to young and old. There was a problem with the location in the town. Even with the soil being rich for farming, it was located too close to the Nasisco River. It would flood the area and could make farming difficult. It was recorded in 1993 to have flooded 10 times. Therefore, the farmers would have to replant or wait till later in the season to get their planting done. Dunlap is currently known as a ghost town in Kansas. The last African-American to reside in Dunlap was London A. Harness. He was buried in 1993 in the Dunlap Black Cemetery. Many African-Americans came to Kansas and didn't receive all they thought they should receive based on the stories that they had been told. Even so, Abraham Lincoln had passed the Homestead Act in 1862. This did entitle them to land within the state for a small filing fee, plus they had to improve the land within 5 years. With the many disadvantages of the people, as well as the land, many didn't succeed and returned to the South. Most African American colonies established during this time frame lasted only a few months or years. Lack of economic opportunities or drought years were the common causes for dwindling populations in the entire region. Colonies in Wyandotte and Shawnee County became part of the bigger, larger town nearby and are now part of Kansas City and Topeka, Kansas. In some cases, remnants of buildings or foundations are still visible, such as in the Quidaro, while at other colony sites, it has become part of a pasture or cultivated field, such as in Hogman Center. In Wabunsee and Dunlap colonies, cemeteries testify to their prior existence. They had many battles to overcome with the land, the weather, the economy, as well as other people around them. Some moved on to other places, and some stayed and made their way for their descendants to succeed. Some examples of famous African Americans from Kansas represented in many walks of life are included here. Of African Americans in Kansas has always been small, the very beginning of Kansas was wrapped up in the fate of the African Americans.
The city of Taft began as an all-black town allotted to freedmen of the Creek Nation. Taft grew and prospered, boasting a population of 690 in the 1930s, but it has dropped to under 400 residents today. That doesn't keep the mayor of Taft, the first African-American woman elected mayor of a city in the United States, from working to bring the town back.
Right now, I would say the population has dropped to around 300 and something, maybe 340, maybe somewhere like that. Now I can remember going to the five stores that we had in Taft. I can remember the cotton gin. I used to see my mother them. You know, I picked cotton, but I didn't have to pick cotton because I was the baby. But I can remember my mother and father driving to the cotton gin in the wagon, you know, and we'd be laying on the cotton, going to weigh the cotton. It's, you know, it's just like it's as if it happened yesterday. So I can remember those days. We had four grocery stores. We had some post office. We still have a post office, but we had a solid post office. We just have one now just in a portable mobile home trailer. We had a drugstore. We had a doctor's office. I can remember that. I can remember going to that drugstore and sitting up on top of the, sitting on the, at the counter because they had a real wide mirror in the back, and you could order a dip of ice cream for a nickel. And a nickel was hard to get. A nickel was really hard to get, you know. A vibrant town to a sad town, because it does sadden my heart that I don't see the sidewalks and I don't see the houses and I don't see the stores and the business. And, you know, but I feel strongly that, you know, you may give out, but don't give up. I think the future still holds a gold mine for Ty. That's my belief.
This is African American History is American History. Welcome. I'm your host, Harlan Kearsley. This program's goal is to foster understanding, promote discussion, and expand knowledge through stories of historical events, bios of unsung heroes, as well as timely and relevant news stories, which hopefully will paint a vivid picture of the effects of segregation, discrimination, and bigotry on the lives of both blacks and whites. Comparisons will be made between the many racially fractured periods of American history and what's going on right now.
Sarah Rector was born on March 3, 1902, near the all-black town of Taft, Oklahoma, on what was then known as Indian Territory. At the age of only 11, Sarah Rector became an oil baron. By the age of 12, she was getting marriage proposals on a daily basis from men both black and white. Sarah Rector became so wealthy that the Oklahoma legislature actually declared her to be, wait for it, a white person. White newspapers, both domestic and international, began referring to her as the richest colored girl in the world. This is her story.
It's funny. Lately, I've been thinking a lot about my life before I came into all this money. I learned over the years that money will make you rich and comfortable, but it still won't make you free, especially if you're black. My parents were both born in 1881, Joseph and Rose Rector. They were both African descendants of Creek Indians, and both of their fathers fought with the Union Army during the Civil War. I had six brothers and sisters, Roy, Rosa, Lily, Rebecca, Joe Jr., and Lou. We all lived in a two-room cabin near Twine, Oklahoma, on Muskegee Creek Indian allotment land through the Dawes Act of 1887, which authorized the President of the United States to subdivide Creek lands among the Creeks and their former slaves. My parents, my brothers, and sisters, we all received a small parcel of land, but the land granted to former slaves were usually rocky and of poorer agricultural quality. The more fertile land was reserved for white settlers. My allotment of 160 acres was valued at $556.50. To say we were poor would be an understatement. In order to make enough money to pay the $30 annual property tax, my father leased my allotment to the Standard Oil Company. That was in February of 1911. By 1913, they hired an independent oil driller, B.B. Jones, to drill wells on the property, and he produced.
A gusher. A gusher is a daggum gusher.
What does that mean?
Why, little missy, it means you're going to be one rich color gal.
That one well produced 2,500 barrels of oil a day. And at 11 years old, I started receiving a daily income of $300. And remember, this was 1913. So in today's dollars, that would be over $7,000. The other wells on my property were just as productive. And by my 12th birthday, I was receiving royalties of $11,567. Again, that would be just over $284,000 in today's money.
The Denver Star. A Negro girl's income is the highest in the entire state of Oklahoma.
The news about my newfound wealth seemed to spread worldwide. I was receiving requests for newspaper interviews, banks were lining up to beg me to trust my money with them, and people I didn't even know were asking me for loans. I even received marriage proposals from four white men from Germany.
Kansas City Star. Oil made Pickaninny rich. An Oklahoma girl with $15,000 a month gets many marriage proposals. Four white men from Germany want to marry the Negro child that they might share her fortune.
Apparently to them, my being black and only 12 years old took a back seat to my being incredibly rich. As I was underage, my parents were my legal guardians and handled my financial affairs. That is, until I struck it rich. We quickly found out that there was a law at the time that required all full-blooded Indians, black adults, and children who were citizens of the Indian Territory to be assigned a white guardian. Funny, this law only applied to those Indians and blacks that came into a significant sum of money. Standard Oil put pressure on my father to hand his guardianship over to a local white resident named T.J. Porter.
The Ottumwa Tri-Weekly Courier. The 12-year-old Negro girl is under sympathetic guardianship. J.T. Porter promises the girl will receive the best education of which she is capable.
We were assured that he was a well-respected man with only my best interest in mind. At least, that's what we were told. The first thing T.J. Porter did was contact the Oklahoma legislature to have me declared a legal white person. That way, I would be allowed to travel in first-class accommodations as was befitting my newfound wealth and position. As word spread of my wealth, I was making headlines around the world. But the truth was, J.T. Porter was robbing me blind. But I had no idea my estate was being mismanaged, or that I wasn't living or dressed in the style of a woman with my wealth.
This is African American History is American History.
The Chicago Defender soon came to my rescue. At that time, the Chicago Defender was the country's most influential black newspaper. In 1914, they published an article calling out my white guardian. The story caught the attention of both Booker T. Washington and W.E.B. Du Bois. They contacted my parents and offered to help improve my situation. Soon lawyers from the NAACP got involved, not only to improve my rights, but the rights of all black children in my situation. W.E.B. Du Bois wanted to make sure my situation was never repeated, so he created a children's department at the NAACP. The department investigated claims of white guardians mistreating black children around the country. James C. Waters, Jr. was the children's department's lead agent. He worked with the Bureau of Indian Affairs and the U.S. Children's Bureau to correct the mismanagement of my estate and have J.T. Porter removed as my guardian. After seeing firsthand my situation, he quickly wrote to W.E.B. Du Bois.
Dear Dr. Du Bois, this is to inform you of the growing concerns I and other members of the NAACP have regarding the mismanagement of young Sarah Rector's estate. The child is clearly being taken advantage of by her white financial guardian, who holds neither Miss Rector nor her family with any regard whatsoever. I have also apprised the Bureau of Indian Affairs and the United States Children's Bureau of my concerns. Is it not possible to have her cared for in a decent manner and by people of her own race, instead of by a member of a race which would deny her and her kind the treatment accorded a good yard dog? Any advice you can render would be most welcome. Sincerely, James C. Waters, Jr., Special Agent for the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People.
Booker T. Washington also helped. In October of 1914, I was enrolled in the Children's School, a boarding school at the Tuskegee Institute in Alabama. It was headed by Mr. Washington. When I turned 18, I left Tuskegee, and on March 3rd, 1920, I moved my entire family to Kansas City, Missouri. I always wanted to see Kansas City. And now, I had the means to see it in style. I owned stocks and bonds, a boarding house, a bakery, and I moved my family into what is still referred today as the Rector Mansion. When I was 20, I married a local Kansas City businessman, Kenneth Campbell. Kenneth had a Hupmobile dealership on 19th and Vine. The wedding was bittersweet, because just 2 months earlier, my father passed. I was looking forward to him walking me down the aisle. Anyway, the wedding was a very private affair. Only my mother and Kenneth's grandmother on his father's side were in attendance. The press, who for some reason was still obsessed with me, reported that our wedding was extravagant. It wasn't. The press loved to report on my spending. They said I had quite a taste for fine clothing and fast cars. And you know something? They were right. I enjoyed my wealth. And yes, I was frequently stopped by the police for speeding. I believe that just about every officer in Kansas City at one time or another had given a speeding ticket to that rich colored gal with the fast cars, which are way too expensive for someone of her race to have. And even though Kansas City at that time was segregated, my money seemed to magically lift those barriers. Jacquard's was a very high-end jewelry store that was closed to Negroes. But those doors swung open wide for me, or rather, for my money. I would literally stroll into white establishments, often and without any trouble. The Jim Crow laws in Missouri at that time said Negroes couldn't use fitting rooms to try on clothing before purchasing. But I did, and I never had a problem. 'Cause those high-end store owners didn't see black. They only saw green. I also hosted many elegant dinner parties at my home. Many leading members of the black community were there. Some of the guests are names you all would probably know even today. Celebrities like Count Basie, Duke Ellington, Joe Louis, and Jack Johnson. Kenneth and I had three sons, Kenneth Jr., Leonard, and Clarence. When they were of school age, I found out that many of the black children in the neighborhood weren't allowed on the buses and were forced to walk miles to school. So I had my chauffeur drive my children, along with others in the neighborhood, to and from school. In 1928, Kenneth partnered with Homer Roberts, an auto dealership out of Chicago. It was an opportunity to expand his business by tapping into a bigger and wealthier Negro market. Roberts Campbell Motors was only the second Negro-owned auto dealership in the country, things were looking great. That is, until 1929, when the Depression hit. It was like a punch in the face. Everything just stopped. All my investments went south. Kenneth lost the Kansas City dealership. He moved to Chicago to try and keep Roberts Campbell Motors from going under as well. He couldn't, and by 1930, we were divorced. Kenneth took the two older children to live with him in Chicago. As I watched my fortune disappear, I was forced to sell most of my real estate holdings, as well as my mansion in Kansas City, and move to a much smaller home. In 1932, I sold my parcel of land back in Oklahoma. All I could get for it was $100. In 1934, I remarried. William A. Crawford was a baker who owned his own restaurant on 18th and Vine here in Kansas City. He was a good man, and I knew he loved me for me and not for my money, 'cause I didn't have any more money.
What's it like to live where you work? For most of us, that's unthinkable. But imagine living and working at one of the biggest factories in the world. A workplace the size of Monaco. For these 17,000 employees, it's reality. They come from all over China, seeking a brighter future at this factory called Yupa. Workers craft coffee makers, irons, and electric grills in staggering quantities every single day. But Yupa is more than a steady paycheck. It's home. People get married here. They send their kids to school here. But the work never stops. Yupa's managers are on a mission to produce new products for every corner of the globe that could forever change the way we think of made in China. Step behind the closed doors of modern China into a factory the size of a city. Welcome to the place that calls itself Factory of the World. By the time you finish watching this program, Yupa's 17,000 Chinese workers will produce nearly 20,000 electrical appliances. Every day they churn out 60,000 irons. Every month, Yupa makes 36,000 coffee makers. That's two new machines for every Starbucks on the planet. And every year, these laborers produce a staggering 18 million electric grills. Stacked side by side, they'd span the Atlantic from New York to London. Chances are you own something built right here. Factories like these don't exist in North America or Europe. But they're not uncommon in China, where labor is cheap. Yupa runs on human sweat alone. No need for robots. To ensure non-stop production, workers need a steady stream of parts. Someone has to make sure those parts get to the right place in time. This is Ming Long Fa. He started work at Yupa in 1994.
I'm in charge of production control. Production control is the brain of the factory. Its main function is to coordinate each department.
If any of Yupa's factories run out of parts, Mr. He's job is on the line.
The production line cannot wait. We have to guarantee that our production is smooth. Running out of materials would affect our efficiency, affect our productivity, and affect our revenue. So I have to fix this in the shortest time possible.
Today, a problem at the iron factory needs smoothing out. Workers on the iron line are low on a crucial part. To keep up production, they need 2,000 units, and they need them now.
Just now I found out the main problems here at the iron department. One major problem is the case for model 603. They need 2,000 right now.
Traditional plants use outside suppliers for their components, not Yupa. To slash costs and stay competitive, Yupa builds its own parts on site. So Mr. He's supplier is only a bike ride away. But even the supplier is dangerously low on stock. Mr. He has found barely enough parts to last the day. When he gets another urgent call, now the grill factory is low on a crucial component. Grills are the company's most profitable products. Yupa started producing one line of grills in 1994. Now, 60 assembly lines churn out 800 different models. Workers make one grill every 12 seconds. That's 50,000 grills per day, or 1.5 million per month. Enough grills for every person in Dallas. Grills bring in $350 million a year. But Yupa wants more. Little wonder Lu Jinye acts like a general leading his troops to war. By next year, managers expect workers to crank out $500 million worth of grills. Yupa's profits have to rise to outmuscle the competition. Mr. Ye supervises 850 workers on 30 lines.
We have to coordinate all these workers and pull all their thoughts into one. It takes teamwork to accomplish our goals, to get the results we want.
Mr. Ye is obsessed with quality control. His aim? Boost output without compromising quality. In a factory this big, with a production run so massive, even the hyper-efficient Mr. Ye hits a roadblock.
This holder piece holds the grill plate. What we're seeing now is the assembly of this piece. The problem is the size. It's the wrong size.
They've run out of part number 2627. It attaches the core heating element to the frame. Without this simple component, assembly lines will shut down, unless Mr. He finds a fresh supply, and soon.
If we don't get them the parts, 6 production lines will have to stop.
When every part is on hand, grills assemble like a simple puzzle. Wires are linked to the heating element, and the element is fixed to the plate.
When it's not locked down properly, it will fall off. If it falls off, it will burn the hands of our customers and consumers. This job is very important.
Then it's time to connect the power cord.
The brown wire is live and the green wire is neutral. The one with the writing on it matches the brown wire. Connect them and that makes the wire live.
Each grill is inspected for flaws in construction or appearance. Finally, every grill is tested to make sure everything is in working order. On a typical day, Mr. Ye's team must make 700 of Yupa's 50,000 grills. Missing parts cause delays, cost Yupa a fortune, and force workers into overtime to meet their quota. Finding the missing parts falls to Mr. Ha, and the pressure is on. Mr. He finally arrives, and he has good news. He's found 2,000 parts to keep the lines moving, and 50,000 more are on the way. Mr. He's day has ended on a high note. He heads home to a company-subsidized apartment only minutes away. His wife, Hong Zhang-yu, also works for the plant. Together, they lead a life of relative luxury. Family life in China is a communal affair. His parents and his in-laws live here, thanks to Yupa. It's one more reason workers are fiercely loyal to their company.
Our products all have the Made in China tag. I hope our products can bring to consumers a sense of joy, a sense of it's worth it. This is my biggest wish.
Fulfilling that wish will come at a cost.
When I first arrived here, I didn't know anyone else, and we all have to live together. It was really tough in the beginning.
Yupa's next generation of workers must leave their families behind and devote their lives to the company. It's a place tourists never see. The new face of modern China, competitive, hungry for profits, and ready to take on the world. Located near the city of Xiaomeng, the Yupa complex sprawls for 1.8 square kilometers, almost the size of Monaco.
We have about over 20 buildings here. You know, the largest building, you know, equal like 4 football fields. You can have 60 to 70 assembly line. Each assembly line can have 25 to 35 workers in the line.
25 years ago, there were no factories here, only farms. In the 1980s, the Chinese government decided capitalism...
I'm a ref being chased out of town after the worst game of my career. You forget one down and the whole stadium turns on you. And if you have cut rate insurance, it may not pay for all this. So get Allstate. You can save money and be better protected from mayhem, like me.
Shop less, get more. Make one call to an Allstate agent.
The communist regime established so-called special economic zones, designated places for free markets and foreign investments. Yupa, a Taiwanese company, moved here in 1988. In a few short years, it became the largest manufacturer of irons, electric grills, and espresso makers in the world. Yupa is a city unto itself, with restaurants and convenience stores, soccer fields and basketball courts, and living quarters for everyone from students to families. Success made it big, and size keeps it successful. Mass production runs push down costs. Almost all parts are made on-site, keeping supply costs low and parts within easy reach.
Because we are in this location pretty much isolated, we don't have satellite suppliers surround us to build, you know, parts for us. So we had to do it in-house, and we had to do it in a large scale.
Yupa's main advantage is a cheap and endless labor force, ready to work for a fraction of a Western wage. 16-year-old Mao Fen Guo left her family and came here in 2008. But Guo isn't just looking for work. She's here to escape poverty and make her mother proud. In China, many parents prefer sons to daughters.
My mother has only two daughters. She's always upset about that. And in order to not let her down, I must work harder and harder.
Guo is a worker in training. With about 1,000 other students, she attends Yupa's on-site trade school. To get here, she had to pass entry exams and pay Yupa tuition. Now she's enrolled in 3 years of study and hands-on training at the factory. If she does well, Guo hopes for a job at Yupa.
At the very beginning, I thought it was very hard. But now that I've gone through all this, it's easier. There's a lot to learn, but I'm still full of confidence.
Today, she and her classmates are learning everything they ever wanted to know and more about irons. To get a job, Guo must learn the ins and outs of every product line.
We're changing constantly. Last time, we were making grills. Then we changed to coffee makers, and now electric irons.
Workers on 27 production lines pump out an iron every 15 seconds, and as many as 60,000 irons a day. Production includes at least 10 separate brands for dozens of companies. With over 30 steps to assembly, iron making is intricate work, and there's no room for error. Assembly starts with a water spray unit, made up of springs, rubber, and washers. With training and practice, it snaps into the spout in seconds.
If it's not closed tight, it will leak or blow. Then it won't work properly.
Now the sprayer and spout are joined to the handle. The two parts of the water reservoir are placed in a heating machine. That melts the space between them and makes the reservoir watertight.
Welding is an important part of production. However, it will be easy as long as we follow our operational guidelines.
Next, the thermostat is attached to the base.
You need to make sure you're using the correct format before you insert the base. Using a wrong base can lead to fire. Wiring is also important. Where there is a wiring mistake, there's hidden trouble.
A plastic buffer is placed between the heating element and the handle to keep the handle and the user's hand from getting too hot. After that, the plug is welded to the back of the iron.
We're connecting the wire for the power supply. I can do about 4 to 5 pieces every minute and 300 pieces an hour.
Once the spray and steam buttons are attached, it's testing time. First, the steam and squirting functions. Second, the iron's electrical system. Faulty units are either repaired or removed. Finally, irons that pass inspection are packed up and shipped away. The team won't cut corners or settle for second best. Today, Guo and her classmates will put classroom theory into practice and work the iron mine. For a teenager from a small town, living and working in a giant factory can be overwhelming.
My life is not as hard as it was before. I'm getting used to this place now.
Work on the iron line goes better than expected. For Guo, juggling work and school isn't that difficult. The hard part is leaving family and living far from home.
I guess it's
learning how to be independent. When I first arrived here, I didn't know anyone else, and we all have to live together. It was really tough in the beginning.
Like China, Guo is adapting to a new world of high technology and tough international competition. And like China itself, she's determined to succeed.
I don't see myself working on the production line forever, doing the same job. Maybe I'm a bit arrogant or too confident about myself, but I want a better future.
For some people, a better future keeps them married to their job. Workers at Yupa are married to the company. Based in southeast China, Yupa is one of the biggest factories on the planet. Today and every day, its 17,000 workers are getting the world ready for breakfast. In the next 24 hours, it will produce 1,200 conventional coffee makers. Over the next 30 days, these assembly lines will deliver 210,000 cappuccino espresso machines. In the space of 1 year, nearly 2.5 million coffee makers will pour out of Yupa and into the kitchens of the world. At the center of all this is Young Lee.
We already have 200 or 300 styles, and we develop and add over 40 new styles every year.
Lee's mandate is crucial and broad. Tackle any problem that could slow down non-stop production.
We have to make every effort to find these problems and to solve them. We have to make sure that every process is working perfectly. Manufacturing shouldn't be delayed because of these problems.
Today, he's got a brand new kind of problem. One of Yupa's big clients has designed a new coffee maker. It's up to Lee to build a working prototype to entice the client into going ahead with mass production. Hundreds of Yupa jobs and millions of dollars in potential business are now in Lee's hands.
Making prototypes is a large portion of my job and is vitally important to the development of the company.
Lee starts by assembling the heating system for the water and steam. Then he carefully places it into the main body. Just when Lee's ready to assemble it all, there are parts missing. The supplier is just a walk away, a long walk, but Lee doesn't mind the distance. Someone special is waiting for him at the supply
depot.
The person helping him today is his girlfriend. These perks make Yupa more than a place of work. With a workforce of 17,000, many of them married with kids, this factory city turns office space into personal space.
Sometimes we work together. For example, if we need the help from the technician to solve production problems, then we meet each other afterwards.
Li Yang Li works in the parts supply department. She first came to Yupa in 2004.
We fell in love at first sight. I always think it must be God who makes her work here and wait for me. Even now, I still think the same.
Yupa management encourages these intimate connections. They believe couples that work together are more loyal to the company.
By working in the same company, we can go to work together and take care of each other. We can see each other more often. What's more, we can be with each other when we have a problem.
With the missing parts in hand, Lee is ready for wiring. Making it all fit into the chamber isn't easy.
I will have to organize all the electrical wires properly to make sure the coffee maker operates safely.
But the real test will come after shipping. If the client approves of Lee's model, Yupa could get a massive order. If it doesn't, hundreds of jobs are on the line.
If I make the prototype in a sloppy way, our customers will lose confidence in the quality of our products. It will be a great loss to our company.
Weeks later, Lee's model is approved for mass production. And right away, he sets out to create a brand new production line. It takes a week to prepare the assembly line and train the workers to make the new coffee machine.
Making a coffee maker is not an easy job at all. It requires professional knowledge and a profound understanding of coffee culture.
When the prep is done, Factory City springs into action and works with astonishing speed. Lee's prototype took half a day to make. Now line workers churn out 700 machines a day. Lee's shift is done, and when work ends at Factory City, romance begins.
When we're done work, we normally go shopping together or take a walk. It gives us a sense of happiness.
The couple plan to get married at a mass wedding, paid for and organized by the company. All at once, dozens of Yupa workers will tie the knot, while thousands of co-workers look on.
If we take part in the group wedding, with the best wishes of all of our co-workers here, we know we will be getting married in the factory of the world, one dream, and that would be unforgettable.
A mass wedding is the couple's way of showing their love for each other and their passion for Yupa. Chef Xing Ming Li has a passion of his own, feeding the 17,000 workers that power the factory of the world. At Factory City, the day has barely begun. But Chef Xing Ming Li already faces his first daily deadline. Li runs one of five independent restaurants at Yupa. Competition between them is intense. Profits are razor thin, and Li needs thousands of customers every day just to survive. In his eyes, he's not just serving meals, he's fueling the workers that power the factory of the world.
If they don't eat well, or eat enough, they won't have enough energy. Then they won't perform well at Yupa.
It all starts with fresh ingredients. Beef, pork, bok choy, onions, carrots, and winter melon.
We have all fresh seasonal vegetables here. Whatever you can find from the food market, you can find here.
Everything is washed, sliced, and diced. Yupa churns out millions of kitchen appliances a year. But there are no food processors in Lee's kitchen. Nothing is automated. Everything is done by hand. By 9 a.m., Lee's staff is already racing against the clock.
We'll have to finish everything before 11 o'clock because Yupa staff restaurants all open at 11:30. We have to be there in advance.
In 2 hours, 3,000 workers will stop.
I'm a ref being chased out of town after the worst game of my career. You forget one down and the whole stadium turns on you. And if you have cut rate insurance, they may not pay for all this. So get Allstate. You can save money and be better protected from mayhem, like me.
Shop less, get more. Make one call to an Allstate.
Lee expects just as many for dinner. This means his staff of 50 must serve 6,000 meals by sunset. That's 125 kilograms of oil, 50 kilograms of beef, and 300 kilograms of pork. That's more than 1 million tons of food every year. His chefs turn stock ingredients into hundreds of delicious dishes.
We can make different cuisines. Our chefs are all the best of their hometown.
They cook up dishes from Fujian, Sichuan, and Henan regions, and they'll soon add halal fare for Muslim clients.
I believe everything that we cook should taste like what your mom cooks for you at home.
Lee's obsession with food comes from growing up hungry.
My family was very poor. Although my dad was working very hard to earn money, we still didn't have much food to eat.
Now, food is never in short supply, and all of Lee's clients return to work with their bellies full. Lee's passion for food has made him a perfectionist. He hunts the market for produce that's perfectly ripe and reasonably priced. In his kitchens, Lee controls the cooks, and no dish goes out without his approval.
Too bland. Some salt and chicken stock will make it taste better.
The special today is spicy Sichuan pork.
Actually, anyone can cook. The key is our chefs make their own special seasonings that you can't get from the market.
Lee insists the pork must be extremely fresh. He expects perfect timing from every cook.
Timing is what the chefs are really good at, but they may not be willing to share that information.
But now it's almost 10 a.m., and Lee's kitchen is about to hit the boiling point. With the clock ticking, the team of chefs are stir-frying and stewing to feed an army.
It might be a bit of an exaggeration to say that it's a battlefield, but it's true that we're really busy. We have to finish everything within 1 hour. Then we will deliver them to our restaurants. We don't have time to do other things.
By 11 a.m., they pull it off. Dozens of different dishes for 3,000 people and right on time. Drivers rush the dishes to the restaurant nearby. Competition between the five independent restaurants at Yupa keeps quality and choice high and prices low. Workers pay about 50 cents per meal, thanks to a company subsidy. To turn a profit, thousands of customers must pass through Lee's door each day. But it's not profits that keep Lee up at night. More than anything, he wants people to enjoy his food.
I've experienced a lot of sleepless nights. I often blame myself for the mistakes that occurred in the daytime. I should have done better.
So far, his customers look happy. After lunch, while workers crank out appliances, Lee will be planning dinner, determined to satisfy his next 3,000 customers.
I hope that Yupa and everyone else will trust me and become my friends. I'll be content if they all come to dine in my restaurant.
If feeding workers at the factory of the world is tough, try being the guy who must make everyone get along. In this factory city, 17,000 people live and work inside 1.8 square kilometers. Rush hour is a human traffic jam. Just getting to work on time is a job well done. Inside these walls, office politics and conflicts play out on a massive scale. The man managing all this human friction could have Yupa's toughest job of all. Now in his second year on the job, Ya Xin Fu is the manager of Yupa's service department. His job, address anything that affects the day-to-day life of Yupa's 17,000 workers.
I have to find a balance between the costs of the company and the needs of the employees. Too little and the employees will be dissatisfied. Too much and the company won't be happy, so it's a big challenge.
Keeping Yupa's army of laborers in line is no small task. At this regular weekly meeting, Fu is boosting company morale.
Leading them is like raising children. We have to raise them with love.
Yupa's workers come from every corner of China. Most are in their 20s and 30s. They work on average 40 hours a week and make between 90 and 320 US dollars a month. While wages are even higher in big cities like Shanghai, many Yupa workers make double what they did back home if they had any work there at all. As with any mass organization, thousands of employees create endless demands. It's Mr. Fu's job to address all of them. He does everything he can to keep everyone motivated and committed to staying at the factory of the world. Fu visits staff living quarters as part of his regular rounds.
We're now going to the workers' dormitory. I routinely go there to check if anything can be improved. If there is, I will talk to the superintendent.
Fu is part landlord and part tenants' rights advocate. Today, he's ensuring Yupa rooms are ready for a group of new workers. Average rent is only $6 per month, but the type of accommodation depends on a worker's rank and the amount of money they are willing to part with. Fu is paying a visit to Mao Fen Guo, who has a noise complaint. Fu believes that to build quality products, Yupa's workers must be well rested and well fed.
The challenge is that there are 17,000 employees and they come from all over China. Everyone has different tastes. I have to take care of everybody.
Yupa's restaurants are extremely competitive, and some have been known to skimp on meat portions to keep costs low. Yupa has strict rules about when and where vendors can sell their food. Fu keeps them in line.
Now we are going to check on the other restaurants. We have designated areas for them. If they break the rules, I will kick them out.
These vendors aren't trespassing. They work for the factory's restaurants. but they are breaking the rules by selling food too close to rival restaurants. Everyone must have a permit.
那你们的通行证呢？像这个外三车，外三车这个牌呢？在哪里？在楼上。怎么能在楼上？这个是随车要带着走。
A veteran on these streets, Fu recognizes this woman. He busted her once before.
撤销会把撤销你，这样是违规。哦，不好意思，没有。你讲多少次了，不能这样。Today,
Fu lets everyone off with a warning. Next time, he may ban them from selling food at Yupa.
I talk to them, but they will break the rules again, so I have to check on them every day.
今天菜怎么样？
China's web of cultures complicates Fu's job.
Everyone comes from different families and different provinces, so their customs of eating and living are totally different. So I have to adapt to them.
But one thing unites all of Yupa's workers, the world's most popular sport. On the field, tension and stress vanish.
我觉得因为员工在工作上，
Because employees are undergoing a lot of pressure at work, we have to give them an outlet and let them exercise. But most important is the team building.
Don't care for soccer? Yupa offers other ways for workers to get their exercise.
For entertainment, we have ball game competitions like basketball, table tennis, and other games. These sorts of competitions.
It's all part of Fu's mission at one of the world's biggest factories, a place with no boundaries between work and life. For Fu, it's a never-ending battle to keep the peace and to keep the company together.
It really is a miracle, a company this big, with all the employees together, holding hands and moving forward. This is not easy.
And while there may be harmony inside Yupa's walls, outside, competition is cutthroat. In a global market, innovation is key. Yupa's employees must endure tough changes to survive. In the global marketplace, there's no room for second best. To survive, companies need a competitive edge. Like most China-based companies, Yupa has relied on low labor costs, making products designed by others. But it wants to move up the production food chain. Yupa's leaders want to design products of their own. They have little choice. To thrive and survive, Yupa must develop a new generation of products. The factory's very existence depends on it. Thousands of jobs hang in the balance.
No work means not being able to live. This is a fundamental requirement. It's how humans survive. You have to earn money to make a living, and to earn money, you have to work.
Jirong Pan knows how high the stakes are. He is Yupa's Vice President of Product Innovation.
I think innovation is the competitive edge of our company. Because our company is in the field of home appliances and the whole home appliance industry is a lifestyle industry.
Mr. Pan sent his staff overseas to study the lifestyle products of the future. They returned with a simple message. The future is green.
We studied the consumers of North America and Europe and their thoughts on this new energy of the future. So we know that their love of the earth is actually very strong.
Pan and his designers make a bold decision. The first appliance in Yupa's new product line will be powered by the sun. It's a solar CD player.
We want to bring this clean solar energy concept into people's homes.
Going solar may sound easy, but solar panels are expensive, and they're meant to work outside, not in the dim corners of people's homes. A 3D image of Yupa's appliance of the future starts to emerge. Now the team must turn a digital design into reality.
This factory is a very important part of our development process. It helps turn a product concept into a finished prototype.
Using the design specs, a computerized milling machine cuts a foam cast. And the cast is converted into a hard plastic prototype. If things go according to plan, the model will be used to produce millions of identical copies.
It allows us to test the product to see if this fulfills our requirements while bringing value to the customers.
Now engineers perfect the solar power system. The system must collect and store solar energy. Every aspect of design must maximize energy efficiency.
We've spent a lot of time studying this. What kind of technology, what kind of material, what kind of parts can help us improve our energy efficiency?
Finally, Yupa's product of the future is revealed. The solar CD player is simple and elegant. The player will charge indoors when left near a window. And the system is uniquely versatile. It will work with any energy-efficient appliance Yupa designs. But one question remains. Will the world embrace Chinese solar products?
We want to bring what people originally thought of as an industrial thing and truly integrate it into their daily lives to enable consumers to truly experience solar energy. This is a very magical energy concept.
If these innovative products succeed, Yupa could achieve its dream, a dream it shares with China, to be the factory of the world.
I want consumers and everyone to have faith in our products and faith in the workers. I hope everyone can enjoy the products we produce. This will make us proud.
With Factory City in full swing and new products in the works, more and more goods will carry the Made in China label. But for China and Factory City, growth comes at a cost. Every day, the 17,000 people at Yupa endure the stress and uncertainty of a cutthroat world economy. To fight off fierce competitors and build a better life, these men and women work and live together as one at the factory of the world.